On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory common ownership development. It is broadcast live from WEBR Fairfax, Virginia. Join us as we explore the world of common ownership development, the fastest growing form of residential development in America today. This housing concept includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single family homes that are part of a mandatory homeowners association. Unfortunately, this type of housing is not as utopian as its advocates would have us believe. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means giving up part of the American dream. It means giving up constitutional rights and control over one's most valuable asset, one's home. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means leaving the American zone. WEBR Fairfax Radio. You're on the Commons. I'm Shu Bartholomew, and joining me on the Commons today is an old friend of ours from Houston, Texas, Wendy Laubach. Wendy is an attorney, and she's one of the few attorneys who actually represents homeowners and works with homeowners and is very much on the homeowner's side. Wendy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's been a while. You used to come on. We used to have you on a lot more. So it's especially nice for me to have you back. It's like having an old friend to chat to. What's going on in Texas? You know, a lot of states have been trying desperately to get some legislation passed somehow, someplace, to try and protect individual and homeowner rights, especially when it comes to foreclosures. And Texas is no different. You did have a bill that was being kicked around, right?
Right. The developments in Texas are actually a little disappointing right now. On the one hand, if you recall, a couple of years ago, there was a lot of publicity over the Winona Blevins case, which was an elderly widow who was forced out of her home over legal fees over a very small dispute. That stirred up enough publicity that the Texas legislature got interested, but that was right at the end of a legislative session, and virtually nothing was done about it in that session, but one of the senators who was interested in the issue extracted a promise from some of his colleagues that in the next session, and in Texas we meet only every 2 years, that then in the next session the issue would be addressed. And he was true to his word. He set up a task force that advised a Senate subcommittee and looked into the issue. And that committee came up with what I think was really quite a good bill. May not have been perfect, but boy, it was a giant step forward. But, you know, there has been some national publicity about the shambles that the Texas legislative session was this year. There was a blow-up over redistricting, and a lot of Senate members fled in order to prevent a quorum from being obtained, and nothing happened for the last week or two of the session. There was a lot of legislative business to be conducted this year. The legislature has just recently changed hands between parties, and you know, a lot of catch-up to do, and basically this bill just didn't make it. It didn't make the final cut. There wasn't enough support for it. There were too many other things going on. And it'll be a while, you know, before we get another session. There may be a special session because of the redistricting issue, but I sure would be surprised if they take this bill up.
Well, so basically you're going to be stuck for another 2 years, right?
Sure sounds like it.
And, you know, in 2 years, you know, you can forget a whole lot over the course of 2 years. And is the story of Winona Blevins going to be forgotten? And is there going to be less of an immediacy, a sense of urgency to get some protection in there for the individual homeowners?
I am concerned that the media attention will flag on this. On the plus side, I think that homeowners associations were pretty horrified by the publicity and by the threat of legislation, and we've not had another dreadful case like that come to light recently. They may be being a little more careful. Now, you know, I mean, the bad side there is that they're keeping all their powers and maybe just behaving themselves for a while, but the good side is that the public was alerted and energized, and, you know, more and more associations members are kind of waking up and looking around and saying, well, if that's going on there, what is my association doing? I get contacted fairly frequently by people who have just begun to pay attention, who've started to take advantage of the really excellent website that Beanie Adolph put together that allows you to look up any homeowners association in Harris County and see what they've done historically. You know, we often find that people go and talk to their boards and are assured that there are no foreclosures in the neighborhood. They go on this website and find out, well, there sure are foreclosures in their neighborhood. They just aren't publicized. So people are starting to look around and take more responsibility for showing up at board meetings and member meetings and having some input. And that may be depressing a bit the ability of the associations to perpetrate some of the worst abuses. But it's not really going to solve the problem unless there's good legislation or a really much more widespread effort of members to take control of their own associations and prevent them doing these things.
But what about, it's not just, you know, some members may take a hold of their associations and may turn things around, but it's like a ping pong match, Wendy. I mean, I've watched it because I've been doing this for 15 years, and it sort of bounces back and forth, and you've got the people who really absolutely want these powers, and, you know, even if you throw them out of office, they'll be back. They're not going anywhere.
You can never relax your vigilance.
You can't. And it's a constant fight. It's the minute you've got one of all this power vested in a small group, I think you polarize an entire community. Because you've got the people who want to enforce, and you've got the people who just don't think it's necessary, and then you've got the greed, the ever-present greed.
And the side that wins is going to be the one that mobilizes more of their neighbors toward their approach. And what I really see, what I see as the worst problem is there are always going to be quite a few people living in any neighborhood who feel awfully strongly about rigid enforcement of deed restrictions, and
That's right.
Who favor, you know, very elaborate and detailed and intrusive deed restrictions. And if you've got a neighborhood where only those folks speak up and are active, and you can't, you know, bring the neighborhood kind of consensus around more toward either relaxing a little on the rules or at least understanding that no enforcement of those rules is important enough to throw one of your neighbors out on the street, you know, if you can't get that dialogue going in your neighborhood, if a lot of people are just kind of opting out of the process, you're going to have a power vacuum. And that power vacuum will get filled immediately as long as there's this really strong financial incentive for professional managers and law firms to come in and exploit it. In Texas, where it's just trivially easy to run up a huge legal bill over a tiny dispute over deed restrictions and then reverse the charges and take those legal fees out of home equity in a foreclosure action, that financial incentive is so strong that any power vacuum will draw those people in. There's just too much money to be made on this kind of lawsuit.
It's not just Texas. I mean, it's all over the country. And I'm getting calls from just about every city and every state where people are in tears. Wendy, people call me up in tears. And they're frustrated. They're at their wits' end. They don't know how to deal with it. They don't know how to handle it. And they just can't find anyone to help them, to work with them. And the associations are getting away with it. They get away with it. You know, the courts seem to be backing them up. Everybody's backing them up.
The courts will back them up almost always. And I have to tell you, I've only ever seen one thing work, and it was not going to court, usually. I've rarely seen that work, except for very wealthy people. The only thing I have really seen work is recall elections. Or annual elections where people actually organize to change a board. And I know, you know, you and I often argue about this and disagree about it because you can see it as futile because, you know, once you take out a board, you still have to keep, and it's true, you can't ever stop. Once you replace the board with more responsible people, you have to make sure that there are more responsible people there from then on. On the other hand, the alternative is intolerable because the alternative is relying on the courts, and the courts will not bail you out of this. And neither will any local government officials that I'm aware of anywhere.
I think it doesn't matter how much money or how little money you have. If you have money, you can hire an attorney. An attorney will come along with you and will go to court. But you look at, there's a lady in Illinois who has spent $500,000 on legal fees.
Mm-hmm.
These are her own legal fees. You know, if she ultimately loses, she ends up with the association's fees as well. You've got
mm-hmm.
someone in Arizona who spent somewhere around $150,000 in legal fees. You've got the Altons down in Virginia, $170,000 That's the association fees that they were required to pay, and I think they had an additional $70,000 of their own. I think Richard estimated somewhere around $250,000.
I would never want to suggest that if you have enough money to spend, you'll win, only that on some occasions I have seen it happen where people who had enough money to spend actually won. I think that the powers given to associations, at least the ones I'm familiar with here in Texas, are so broadly written, so full of discretion, that your chances of being able to win are quite small. Although, you know, now and then you do catch an association in just a flagrant violation of election rules or something, and you can get a whole board disqualified, and sometimes you can get somewhere that way. Normally, what people want to sue over is something that's expressly defined as within the association's discretion, and they can spend all the money they want, and they're still going to lose. That's why I think that unless you can get at the de-restrictions themselves through community action, you know, actual votes of your neighbors to change the rules, or get at the board and put in people who will exercise their discretion more sensibly, nothing else is going to save you unless we can get a law passed. People think that they're going to save themselves by letting the dispute go right up to the eve of foreclosure and then hiring a lawyer, and they lose virtually every time.
Whatever happened to the notion that a covenant is construed at its narrowest form and in favor of the weaker party? Because so many of the headline-grabbing stories, horror stories that we've been hearing about lately have been about associations using very broad language, the language that I think you're referring to enforce something that nobody really agreed to. I mean, nobody
right.
said, I agree not to have a flag, but they're calling the flag a visual nuisance, they're calling the flag an eyesore, they're calling it a structure, they're calling it a loan ornament, and the courts are upholding these descriptions.
In Texas, at least, I think that went by the wayside when the courts quit looking at deed restrictions as a purely private contractual matter, and we started operating under the current statute we have, which more or less makes associations kind of quasi-governments. I mean, the thing that I really hate about the system the most is that it's neither a private contractual matter where you use those old traditional rules where you had some protection, nor is it a purely government matter where you at least have constitutional protections. It's a very uncomfortable hybrid. It seems to be the worst of both worlds. There's no state action because it's not a real government. But it's not exactly like dealing with a private entity either. And unfortunately, the restrictions themselves are, even if you did strictly construe them, the language in the restrictions themselves gives discretion. You've got people moving into neighborhoods where the deed restrictions literally read, you know, the board can pretty much do any darn thing it wants within its discretion. And if you've got enough folks living in that neighborhood who are single-mindedly focused on, you know, the danger that somebody might paint their house orange and that we need, you know, discretion to stop that kind of dreadful, you know, judgment lapse, then there's no talking to some people about the need to make the rules stricter and harder to enforce. I think we have to somehow win the struggle for the hearts and minds of neighbors to make them understand that there are ways to keep neighborhood quality of life issues up without surrendering to sort of a, you know, fascist kind of organization that can take people's homes away.
Well, I mean, what quality of life do people have in an association when they have to reach out to a stranger and sob? I mean, the quality of life just doesn't seem to exist. Although, in a lot of the ads we're going to, you know, we're pushing this return to yesteryear and the Norman Rockwell era and, you know, pedestrian friendly and neighborhood friendly and all of this, but in actual fact they're little war zones, and it's sad, but that's what we seem to be doing, all because we want to control the neighbor. And that's all it basically boils down to. Nobody says, hey, I've got bad taste, so you pick my colors for me. You know, they're just afraid of what someone else might do that might displease them.
Well, there's a lot of what I see is class anxiety. You know, people sort of think, well, people of my sort will can be counted on to paint their homes neutral colors and not have any, you know, cars of the vintage before 1999 in their front yard. But, you know, those other people that we don't want breaking into our neighborhood, you know, we're not sure if we can trust their taste, and so we just want to make sure that somebody can keep a lid on them. If you
It seems to me that
part of what's going on is that people are living among strangers in their neighborhoods. They don't really think of the people next door as people. They think of them as, you know, unwelcome socioeconomic intruders who may do who knows what. In working with my own civic club, which is not, as you know, a mandatory homeowners association, but just a voluntary civic club,
mm-hmm.
you know, we do pay a lot of attention to deed restrictions, and we attempt to work with neighbors to you know, whenever there's a dispute among neighbors, to work it out. The first thing we always ask people is, whatever your neighbor's doing that's bothering you, have you already gone and knocked on their door and you know, told them it's a problem for you and asked them to stop or suggested some alternative? And I'm shocked. I have to tell you, in almost every case, I mean, at least 19 out of 20 cases, the answer I get back is either I couldn't possibly, I don't even know them, in which case
yeah.
my answer always is, how about if you walk across the street and, you know,
get to
introduce
know them.
Yourself, you are
yeah.
a neighbor. Or I get the answer, you know, I do know them, but I couldn't possibly do that because it would, you know, it would make them mad or it would be an uncomfortable interaction. And I think you've got people so unwilling to engage their neighbors as people that they slip far too easily into the attitude of, well, I'll just let this anonymous enforcer take care of it and then I won't have to be embarrassed. And they just don't seem to have any grasp of what a hideous neighborhood quality that leaves you with, and how much better things would be if you could just summon up a little courage and talk to your neighbor like a person.
Yeah, I think you make a great point. You're on the Commons. We're talking to Wendy Laubach today, and I'd like to ask you to get something to write on and something to write with handy, because we're going to be giving you some information here pretty soon that you're going to want to jot down. But that's a good point, Wendy. We used to live in communities. We used to live in neighborhoods. And we're trying to get back to that. But it seems to me that everything we're doing to get back to that era is taking us farther away from it. You know, we've got these deed restrictions. We've got someone to do the restricting for you. You don't have to get involved. And as you point out, you know, you don't have to talk to your neighbor. You don't need to know your neighbor. Just send in an anonymous complaint and we'll take care of it.
And frankly, there are a lot of people who are irritable enough about the fact that they have to send in the complaint. They really want it all to just happen without their input of any kind.
Oh,
you know,
really?
But on the other hand, I was at a civic club meeting the other day that was completely opposite and very encouraging to me. Several people showed up at the meeting to sort of complain about, you know, my neighbor does this, my neighbor does that, why can't anything be done? And the officials of the civic club said, you know what? Young woman, it is no more our obligation to take care of this for you than for you to take care of it yourself. We are all citizens. We all live here. We all have equal individual standing to enforce our own deed restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
And it is up to each of us. Now, this club is here to sort of help each other with it and to coordinate, and we can pass on expertise and experience. But this is not something that you sit back and some, you know, fairy godmother comes and handles for you. It's something for all of us. And frankly, if more neighborhoods had that sense that everybody who lives there is responsible for making it work, I mean, not only the neighborhoods would work better, but that ought to be how all of our politics work. There's way too much sense of letting somebody else somewhere else handle it.
You know, I was on the board in my association many years ago, and I used to get calls from people, you know, my neighbor's doing this and my neighbor's doing that. You know, it never ceases to amaze me how much time people spend spying on each other and worrying about what the neighbor's doing. And they demanded that I do something, and I suggested that instead of doing that, that they go and work with their neighbors. And, you know, where people took me up on that, it was just such a pleasant place. Their little streets or little neighborhoods or whatever you want to call them just did an enormous turnaround, and it was there was a sense of cooperation. It was a real sense of community, because all of a sudden they all realized that they had something in common there, and they got together. They went up and down the street, they painted houses, they replaced house numbers, they just spruced up, they pruned the shrubs, they planted flowers, and the place just sparkled, you know?
Absolutely, and I think people really underestimate how effective it is to talk to their neighbors about what bothers them. Now, you know, I absolutely recognize that there are always going to be some people living in a neighborhood who are very well defended against their neighbors' views and wishes, and who will automatically say no to everything. But that they're uncommon. People, in my experience, most people are really going to listen as long as they get a friendly message to what their neighbors think. They might not say yes right away, but there's a guy a couple of blocks from me whose neighbors were complaining to me that he wouldn't mow and edge his lawn. And in fact, his lawn was awful. I mean, it was an awful lawn. But nobody had really tried to talk to him directly about it. And I finally kind of despaired of their ever doing it. And since I know him a bit and worked with him on something, I said, you know, I sort of hate to bring this up because it should be your neighbors and not me. But I have to admit that when people tell me that they think it looks bad for you never to edge your lawn, I have kind of a point. And boy, I sure would like it if you would edge your lawn. I can't make you. But wouldn't it be nice if you did? I mean, don't you realize that it kind of bothers your neighbors and it's creating some ill will? And, you know, he had to kind of go through the initial process of, well, it's kind of jerky that they didn't talk to me directly, you know. But after we got past that, since I wasn't crosswise with him and I wasn't coming across as some kind of hateful enforcer, he eventually sort of said, well, you know what, I guess it is bothering them, and I guess I should just edge my lawn. And he has been. And that's really all it took was human contact. I mean, that's all it takes.
Yeah, sometimes they don't have an edger. Sometimes, you know, they don't have the time. And so if you're doing it, just go through and do it.
Yeah, you know? And in fact, he's not indifferent to what his neighbors think, even though he doesn't like to be pushed around. And when he calmed down and thought about it, it made him uncomfortable enough to know that they were unhappy with the situation, that he was motivated to get out there every now and then and edge.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much the way I think that it should be done. And you really don't need, but instead what we have is an association, and you have a manager, and you have a manager who writes a letter, and then you have a manager who charges for the letter, and then it goes to the attorney, and pretty soon we've run up thousands of dollars of fees because somebody hasn't edged the lawn. And the
two things I think are wrong with that, I mean, one, and we can get into the whole, you know, bringing in the lawyers and running up the fees. Well, then it's just the money pit. I mean, then it's just a whole financial scam. But I mean, even before you get to that problem, trying to solve the problem with a letter from any kind of official source before you talk to people in person is something that, as far as I'm concerned, you should only do if you're desperate for the process to fail right from the beginning. Because I don't know any human beings who react well to that. A lot of people will react well to personal contact.
Yeah.
But very few people are going to get a letter worded even neutrally and politely, you know, let alone in a hostile or snotty way, and not just get crosswise right from the start. And I mean, if you add a lawyer's letter to that, then give it up right from the start. So you should not be handling this business with, you know, written tickets from, you know, that make you feel like you're in junior high school if you really want the problem solved. You really make human contact if your genuine aim is to solve the problem. Now, if your aim is to stir up a fight so that the law firm can, generate $200 or $300 in legal fees, then absolutely you should start by sending snotty letters.
I absolutely agree with you. When the Winona, we started off talking about Winona Blevins, and there was something that was passed, and I think it was an insult that it was called the Winona Blevins Law. This was right 2 years ago.
Oh, there was barely a bit of a fix put in in the waning hours of the legislative session 2 years ago, and they did call it the Winona Blevins Reform Act or some,
which was ridiculous.
It did a couple of things that weren't too bad, but it was nothing that should have been dignified with the title of a reform law, and it was really more stuff thrown in by the Homeowners Association lobby at the last minute.
Well, what it seems to me at the time, one of the items in there was that you had to make personal contact. You could not send a letter or initiate anything until somebody from the association had gone and knocked on the door and talked to the person.
Well, they at least had to be given an opportunity for a hearing before the board, before some processes could start. I don't recall that it had to be personal contact, however. I think it just had to be notice of the right to a hearing. I do recall that in the task force, the idea was thrown out that maybe there should be some personal contact, and the very, very strong reaction from the association lobby was, we couldn't possibly. I mean,
yeah.
A, we don't have time, and B,
yeah.
we're afraid. We're
yeah.
afraid to go knock on people's doors
yeah.
because they hate us, and we're afraid of violence.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly the point I was going to try to get to, was the fact that the special interests were so adamantly opposed to that.
Absolutely.
And yet they're the ones who are running around going, oh dear, we don't have community. We don't, we need to foster a sense of community here.
I'm afraid what they mean by sense of community is what they call architectural harmony, which is to say architectural lockstep. It's not community in the sense of people actually having personal contact with each other. You don't get that unless you have what I think is a really healthy grassroots participation in the association, which all too few associations have, and you'll have less and less of that to the extent that you turn over the entire operation of the association to a professional management company and a law firm. You know, you got a lot of boards that are just sham boards. They don't even really know anymore what their companies or their law firms are doing, or if they do know, they're busy not paying attention. And I don't think neighborhoods work worth a darn unless the people who actually live there are actually involved in the decisions that are made. They don't delegate everything to strangers.
You know, we advertise these things as being carefree living, and then we say, hey, it's not going to work unless you spend extra time looking over everybody's shoulder. So it's not working, you know. It's really not working. We're going to take a break in a couple of minutes, but before we do, I'd like to give out some websites. And Wendy, you had talked, you mentioned Beanie Adolph's website.
Yes.
And that's hoadata.org.
That's right, hoadata.org. No
yeah.
www, just hoadata.org.
Yeah, there is a www.
I don't think so. But you may get there if you do it, but you don't need to have the www.
Okay. I also, if you're interested in reading on, you know, reading articles about associations, there's a number of them posted on a Yahoo list called The Other Chore. That's all one word. And the web address for that is http://. Now, there is no www here. It is not a World Wide Web. So it's http://groups.yahoo.com/theotherchore, all one word, theotherchore, and go in and you can read up on stories and see articles that are posted there. Also, my website is onthecommons.com, and another wonderful site is ahrc.com. You're going to get a ton of information there. A lot of articles, a lot of personal stories, a lot of interactive stuff at that website. So that's ahrc.com, onthecommons.com, hoadata.org, and groups.yahoo.com, the other chore. So those are all great places for you to go and learn, read up on this. Wendy, when we come back, I don't know, one of the things that I'd really like to talk about is this bill that never made it this year, because there was some really good stuff in there.
Okay.
It's and I don't know if you have it.
Sure.
Okay. And we'll talk about that, folks, because if any of you are out there and you're planning on doing any kind of lobbying or any kind of legislative functioning during the year, there might be some good ideas in this bill that you might not have thought about, but I think that they're wonderful ideas, and you can get these, and we'll tell you, we'll talk about them. And we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. Don't go away. We'll be back.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers,
slither close, but they won't tell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.
WEBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Shu Bartholomew. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions, and I'm very happy to have an old friend, Wendy Law, back from Houston, Texas, on the Commons with me today. Wendy is an attorney, and she's going to be talking a little bit about a bill that didn't quite make it this year, and it would have protected the homeowner rights, especially when it came to foreclosures. Wendy, thanks for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
You said that the bill didn't quite make it. I mean, it was a fairly large bill. I printed it out. It came out to 9 pages. And
yes,
it had a lot of bits and pieces in there that were good.
It did a number of things that I think were very interesting and should be considered, you know, here again the next time we get a chance, and certainly in other states. One of them, the thing I liked probably best about the whole bill, was the concept of a moratorium on legal fees during the first stages of a dispute between an association and a homeowner. The homeowners association could be as aggressive as it liked about pursuing a homeowner, even to the point of bringing in its lawyers right away if it just had to. But the difficulty for the homeowners association was going to be that they could not charge those legal fees against the homeowners in a future foreclosure lawsuit until, you know, X days had passed. And I think we started off with something like, you know, 2 years, and it was going to drop down to some lower amount. But there still was an idea of some moratorium of some length during which the association was highly motivated to work it out with the homeowner, because if it brought its lawyers in, it was going to do it on its own nickel and wasn't going to be able to reverse the charges. And, you know, homeowners associations were not... The homeowners associations have reacted really violently against the idea of limiting attorney's fees, because they feel that if a dispute gets really out of hand, they need to be able to hire the expensive lawyers. This, you know, I don't agree with that particularly, but this provision I think was a nice middle ground, because it told them, you know, you're not permanently going to be prevented from bringing in your lawyers, but if you jump the gun, you're going to have to pay for it yourself. So we don't want to see any more of these situations where somebody has grass in their sidewalk and they get a letter on, you know, Tuesday saying there's grass on the sidewalk, and by Friday there's $2,000 in legal fees run up because of a series of nasty letters, all, you know, all in aid of just ginning up something that justifies a lawsuit getting put on file so that the fees can be extorted out of the homeowner under threat of foreclosure.
But that's what it is. It's extortion, isn't it, right now? Yeah, it's just ridiculous. I mean, you managed to prevent a foreclosure in Houston to collect $38 in fees.
I can't take credit for preventing it. That one got worked out, but we did find out about it and put a lot of publicity out about it. And I think, and it was not just my publicity, but others, I think that that association backed off and disliked the publicity intensely. You know, to tell you the truth, it wasn't even $38 in fees or fines that they were fighting about. It was, I think the one you're talking about is the famous oil stain on the driveway case.
The oil slick.
There were actually no damages specifically relating to the oil stain at all. It's not as though the Homeowners Association cleaned up the oil stain and, you know, had money to charge for it. And it's not even as though the court awarded, you know, the $200 a day penalty that Texas law allows. It was just that the court ruled that a deed restriction had, in fact, been violated, and it was one of those very vague nuisance, you know, provisions. And the law firm, in casting about for something to charge back against the homeowner, all they could come up with was their fees, which were some thousands of dollars, and $38 worth of photocopying and postage charges.
That was totally ridiculous. Well, I do give you credit for it, because you did bring it to the attention, and, you know, once we put it out there, and, you know, everybody got...
That homeowner, I mean, the only reason that home wasn't foreclosed on was that the homeowner paid up. It was not, in fact, a homestead. This was a rental property, and you know, the last minute before the foreclosure, he just paid them off. That's a case where publicity may have helped prevent them from doing that to someone else who was less able to bear up under the pressure. But
the homeowner in question didn't even know that his house was being foreclosed on, did he?
Oh, yeah, you may be thinking of a different one. The one I'm thinking of, the oil sin in the driveway, he was aware. It was a rental property, and...
Well, I thought from my recollection was that he had cleaned off the oil stain and had called the association and was told not to worry about it.
Well, that's true.
And so he
was... By the time they moved forward in foreclosing, he did ultimately figure out what they were up to. But yes, that's right. His position, as stated in court, was that they'd complained about the oil stain, and he went and looked at it and hired somebody to power wash it and thought it was all right. Believed he had checked with a board member and had been told it was all right, and they decided it wasn't really quite clean enough and went forward.
It seems to me nobody had gone back to verify it, because when they did, there was a car parked in the driveway, and so they decided they couldn't see it, therefore it had to still be there.
Right. That was when we started to give them a hard time about it. We said, you know, did you ever... I was really curious about whether they had ever, in fact, cleaned it up, because it seemed to me that they were more interested in being able to charge this guy with fees than in solving the problem of whether there was an oil stain. So
yeah.
I kept saying, has it been cleaned up? Did you pay to have it cleaned up? Do you even care if it's there anymore? And it became apparent they had no idea if it was there or not. And then after we had that conversation, they actually sent somebody by to check, because I think they realized they were going to look pretty awful in court if it went to court, if they didn't know. And their answer was, well, we drove by, but, you know, we couldn't tell if it was there anymore, anymore or not, because there was a car parked, which gave you an indication of how vast and great an oil spill it must have been if it was hidden easily by a single car.
Yeah, well, it started off as an oil stain, and then it went...
Became the oil slick, yes.
And then it became an oil slick, and then they decided that they really couldn't see it because there was a car parked in the driveway anyway.
Right.
And so it cost this guy a ton of money.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't know. We don't know what he settled for, because that was confidential and not revealed. He'd been threatened with thousands of dollars in legal fees. Presumably he paid enough to get them to go away.
And would this bill have prevented something along those lines from happening?
Well,
because it is extortion, Wendy.
The bill would at least have prevented the law firm from running up a lot of fees early on. So during the earlier process, when the homeowner was obviously, you know, trying in good faith to fix this problem and calling them up and saying, is what I did enough? Are we okay now? You know, during that period, the law firm wouldn't have been able to be going behind the scenes running up fees and then charging him. So it would have helped in that sense. One of the other things the bill did was even the playing field a little bit, threaten associations with the loss of their fees, or you know, with having the homeowner's fees stuck on the association if the homeowner, in fact, won. I mean, the way that Texas bill reads, the Texas statute now allows the court, actually requires the court, to award legal fees in favor of a party who sues to enforce a deed restriction and wins. There's no provision for somebody who is sued to enforce a deed restriction and manages to persuade the court that the deed restriction said something else or that the association was out of its mind. You know, unless you're the one enforcing a deed restriction, you have no hope of having your fees awarded. That means any homeowner who's forced to spend a lot of money, even successfully defending himself, always has to pay his own fees and can't reverse them. The association knows that it's a fairly low-risk operation for them. The worst that's going to happen to them is they don't get their fees paid. They're certainly never exposed to being paid to having to pay the fees of the other side, and this bill would have changed that. I think you'd see a lot more careful thought going into lawsuits over really trivial, offensive matters like oil stains and grass and sidewalks and cracked pots on front porches and so forth if associations knew that...
I wouldn't count on it.
They were at risk.
I wouldn't count on that, because that's the way the law reads in Virginia. It says the prevailing party is entitled to costs and reasonable legal fees. And it doesn't stop associations at all, because you know what? The attorneys say it doesn't matter. You know, we'll go after these people and it won't cost you anything, because if we win, we'll get it from the homeowner. So the association says, oh, okay, you know, go for it. And
do you know of cases where the homeowner has won and reversed the charges?
I can't tell you anything offhand. I know that a lot of things have been appealed and gone up to the appellate level and not never been heard by the appellate level. And so what happened when it was remanded back, I don't know.
Well, all I can tell you is it would deter me. I won't try to portray it as a great fix, but it sure couldn't hurt to level the playing field a little bit.
Oh, I agree with you. Absolutely, I agree with you. I think that what's good for the goose has got to be good for the gander. But again, you got to realize how these attorneys, the industry attorneys, seem to be working all the time. And they will. They'll go in and they'll tell the association, hey, wait a minute, you know, you don't have to pay us. You don't have to worry about it because we will pick this up from the homeowner. There's a case going on right now where that, you know, the legal fees are mounting. It hasn't got to court yet. I don't know what's going to happen. But in order to settle, the association wants the homeowners to pay up and cover all their legal fees. You know, and I said, no, in fact, I think that you guys ought to cover their legal fees, but, you know, not the other way around. But again, it's something that's going to go to court, presumably at some point. I don't know. What else did you like about the bill? I mean, it was, like I said, it was a fairly long bill.
It was. One of the things I liked about it, well, one of the things I like least about the bill as it currently reads, is that instead of giving associations only those powers which are specifically granted to them, you know, the way we do our federal government, it basically said associations will have the following 12 or 13 or 14 very broad discretionary powers unless they are specifically taken away by the deed restriction. Now, in the first place, I think that's a terrible way to set up powers of a public body. It's just dangerous. In the second place, unfortunately, the deed restrictions are all, you know, tend to be 20 or 30 years old, and the statute is new, and so most of the deed restrictions didn't have any of that nice protective language specifically denying rights because nobody knew that it, you know, they needed to have it.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a lot of associations out there who are, by statute, granted incredibly broad discretionary powers, even though the restrictions don't say a word about it. And frankly, homeowners just don't know about it and aren't aware of it, aren't alarmed by it, and don't even know enough to get organized and look into it and think about limiting the powers by, say, you know, moving for bylaws changes or trying to organize to change the deed restrictions or controlling the board. The new statute, it didn't completely fix the problem, but there's some language in there about denying powers that are not specifically granted. It starts to tip the balance back toward giving associations only those powers which its members have actually been put on notice are present, so that you have to have people genuinely given some thought to whether it's a good idea to give their association that power. Now, all too often, people will thoughtlessly give that power even so, but at least this is a step in the right direction.
You and I have had differences, as we've talked, differences of opinion in terms of what it takes to sort of make these places a little more homeowner or livable. And you're a great advocate of having a bunch of people take over the association and run it in a saner manner. I know that it can happen. I've done it, but I also realize that it's a temporary fix. It's not permanent, and that these things tend to go bounce back and forth. It's a lot like a ping pong ball. Our ping pong game, it goes back and forth across the table from one side to the other. But one of the ways that they do that is to prevent people from voting. They take away your voting rights. Is there anything, do I remember reading something in this bill about not being allowed to do that anymore?
Yes, proposed in several different forms, but the various different techniques that were sort of being tried out were, there still was some possibility eventually of losing your voting rights, but there was at least some fairly substantial procedure that had to be gone through. Currently, all an association really has to do is kind of assert that you're not a member in good standing at the last minute and you just can't vote. I mean, unless you've got a lot of money to go to court, even then you might lose. The bill would have made it necessary for boards to take official action well in advance of an election and in public, so that people would know going into an election whether they had a fight on their hands about whether they could vote and wouldn't just be denied the right to vote at the last minute when it was too late to do anything about it.
But you're talking about a member in good standing. What does it take to be a member in good standing?
Oh, nobody has any idea. I've never seen bylaws define it. There doesn't seem to be any decent case law on it. It's typically interpreted to mean at least that you've paid your annual assessments, but fairly often it's also interpreted to mean, and, you know, we don't believe in our subjective judgment that you violated any deed restrictions. And so what you see in some neighborhoods is, for instance, in Geneva Kirk Brooks' litigation with her neighborhood here in Houston, one of the prominent fights was over whether the association had been shown to engage in a pattern of sending out a rash of just hundreds of default letters for, you know, for petty deed restriction violations along the lines of the you know, garage eaves painted the wrong color of ecru kind of thing. Presumably and apparently for the purpose of suppressing the vote of people who were known to be in, opposing the board's policies. So that, you know, for instance, you get property managers testifying that in a normal year they'd send out, you know, a certain 100 deed restriction violations in the entire year, but right before the election, within 30, 60 days before the election, they sent out 500. I mean, it clearly was a pattern of vote suppression.
So basically what they were doing was making sure ensuring the outcome of the election, right?
Sure.
And so it makes it a little bit harder, I think, for people to get in there and legitimately take over the board. I mean, if you're going to run and all of a sudden your supporters are not allowed to vote for you.
Absolutely.
And you have just the opposition, and it doesn't help in fostering, I think, a sense of community at all.
And I think in any neighborhood that's got bylaws that allow the board to disqualify a vote, they're seriously asking for trouble. It's very hard to change once you allow that terrible provision to come in. You know, I've had people argue with me often that it's simply necessary because you couldn't bear the idea of letting people have the vote who might not have paid their dues. Now, I understand the problem that people have got that somebody is refusing to pay dues and then votes. But frankly, I think that's just a tiny, tiny little danger. It doesn't even offend me, and I just don't see why it's such a bad idea compared to the demonstrable danger of taking away the votes of people by last-minute action in order to control an election. I mean, you want to see a board really, really entrenched, give them the power to jerk your vote around.
Oh, I know. Oh, they do. And virtually all of them have them. I mean, that's one of the boilerplate. It goes in. I mean, that's been in there for since day one. If you are not a member in good standing, the association can deny you the right to vote. They may deny you the right to vote. They don't have to. They may deny you the right to vote.
On the other hand, I have rarely seen a board succeed in wholesale vote suppression for very long. You can do it. They can probably get away with suppressing the vote of a couple of people who don't have very many allies. But when they start really doing it on a broad scale, not only will somebody eventually be able to put together a court case without spending too much money, but that kind of thing, if that doesn't eventually get the neighborhood stirred up so that there's just too many fighting the board for them to deal with, then the neighborhood must want pretty badly to live in tyranny, is all I can say.
The other thing that we hear about, and that's also very dangerous, is in order to know whether or not there's something going on, sometimes you need to get in there and you need to be able to examine the books and records and to determine whether or not there is a problem and whether or not you want to take time out to run for the board or to try to mount a campaign or do anything along those lines. And typically, people who've gone into their associations and said, look, I really want to look at the financial documents, they've been asked to provide a basis for their request. I mean, why do you want to look at the books and records?
Right.
It's not enough that you're a member. You know, why do you want to do that? And from one of the things I read in this bill is that they couldn't do that anymore. They could not ask you to establish, or they could not ask you why you
right.
want to look at the books and records. All they needed to establish was that you were a homeowner.
They essentially put them under the Open Records Act, although I think that was one of the things that was being fiddled around with at the last minute. But they were certainly going to make it a lot easier for homeowners to get to documents. And in fact, even in the, you know, the quote unquote reform bill from 2 years ago, they took a few baby steps in that direction, but they unfortunately wrote in an exception for any documents that were in the hands of the lawyers. They were trying to protect the privileged documents, but it was drafted too broadly. So this time around, they were going to try to fix that a bit. There was, you know, it was certainly a step in the right direction because there's simply no way to keep a homeowners association its operations honest if you can't have a good bit of sunshine shed on what they're doing.
Well, I think if you're responsible for, you know, for covering any shortfall, then you ought to know what they're up to.
Absolutely.
And so that would have been a great one to add in there. It also provided for penalties And that probably would never get anywhere, would it? If an association refused to comply with the law?
Well,
there would have been penalties imposed.
I mean, I won't say that it would never get anywhere. I just think that kind of thing you have to recognize. It's not self-enforcing. Somebody's going to have to spend some money and go to court if they ever want to, you know, see it enforced.
Yeah, but this included some oversight by the county attorney. And, you know, off the air, we had a little discussion about that. And you didn't think that would ever happen. But here it actually says the county attorney may seek a court order directing the Property Owners Association to furnish the required information. In an action under the section, the county attorney may also seek a judgment against the Property Owners Association for court costs and attorney fees. But the thing is, it's not the people themselves. It's not the managers or the board members who would pay it. It would be all the homeowners who would be assessed this, right?
Right. Or, you know, possibly their insurers. And if they could be demonstrated to have acted outside the authority that was granted to them, possibly themselves personally, but not likely. In general, though, I mean, I don't think it ever really hurts to put that kind of thing in. I just question whether in the long run it's really going to turn out to be that effective for homeowners. What I like to see instead, whenever possible, is defenses to collection and foreclosure, because those are self-actuating. I mean, it's a rare homeowner who's really going to get out there and take advantage of one of these provisions other than in the context of being sued for foreclosure, when they can raise it as a way to stop what the Homeowners Association is trying to do to them. That I think, really motivates the Homeowners Association to get it right, because in the end, if their foreclosure action isn't being effective, their whole extortion gambit doesn't work. It's sort of a self-regulating mechanism in it, and it works for people who otherwise couldn't afford to file their own lawsuit or, you know, try to get an injunction to force the county attorney to act or whatever it was to take to get that kind of thing to go forward.
We're running out of time. There are a couple of other things I really would like to cover as well before we go. One of the things that we've heard a lot about is that associations or managers will go to board members and say, you know, if you hire us, you don't have to pay us. We'll make our money by sending out deed violation letters, sending out overdue notices, by doing inspections, and so on, and we'll just generate our fees from the homeowners.
Right. So in other words, you're hiring a manager who's got a built-in economic incentive to
make life miserable
your members, without regard to whether the members are actually doing anything wrong. The more they find, the more they earn. It's a terrible incentive.
Wendy, how broadly used is that? Is it a problem?
In Houston, at least, I think not very broadly.
Because
I see that. I think that incentive worked very much with the law firms. I don't see it so much with the management companies. I've just not been able to find a lot of evidence of it.
Because it's in the law. It's in this bill. And it's one of the items. And it would seem to me that they probably wouldn't have done anything with this had it not been pervasive or fairly often used.
I'm not sure that's correct. There was a lot of concern voiced about it and a lot of lack of clarity about how much it really existed. But it seemed like such a poor idea that I think they went ahead and said, you know, we're not sure if you're doing it or not, so just don't do it. It's an awful idea.
It is an
awful
idea.
Nobody was sure it wasn't happening. I just don't think they were sure it was either.
Well, I think it was, because I know that a couple of people had heard about it from board members and other people in homeowners associations saying, hey, we're being...
There's anecdotal evidence of it. I just can't ever seem to run down a specific case where I can really confirm it.
Okay. All right.
But, I mean, it is one of the worst possible ideas anybody's ever come up with, and it certainly should be outlawed. And if it's not outlawed by statute, every neighborhood with any sense will outlaw it by bylaw.